Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. Well, how you doing? It has been a little while since I had the last MacCast out, but consequently, you are going to get a really big show today. We've got a lot of great things to cover, lots to discuss, and I think we're going to have a whole lot of fun at the same time. So come along with me. Let's jump right into the Mac news.
Hey, wait a minute. It's not the MacCast.
Nope. It's My Mac Podcast number 117 with our special guest, Adam Christensen from the MacCast.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
And it's another wintry day here in the West Michigan area, and hopefully this snow will clear out before Chad and I have to spend March 10th driving up to Grand Rapids to do our, what's going to be really, I hope, a really successful podcast at the Apple Store. I'm really looking forward to that. Mm-hmm. But we're joined today with a special guest, and that is Adam Christensen from the MacCast. Hi, Adam.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm doing a lot better that you're on the show. Adam and I had emailed a few times in the past. I mean, we're both Mac podcasters, and we both started roughly around the same time. I think Adam started about a month before I did. I started at the very end of December, and I think he started at the very beginning of December 2004. So we were pretty early on this whole podcasting thing, eh, Adam?
For Mac podcasters, yeah, that's very early. Yeah, I was early December, I think. December 13th. So I guess mid-December is really more accurate.
You know how I found out about you? After I started our podcast, I thought, wow, I think I should name this, like, instead of podcast, a MacCast. So I went and did a name search, and it was already taken.
And I went, wow.
Oh, who's got the MacCast?
I just barely snuck in there then.
You did, literally, because I was going to go grab that, and it was already taken. I said, it'll just be the My Mac Podcast until I come up with a better name, and... Here we are over 2 years later, and it's still the My Mac Podcast.
Now, you had the website for a while before that, right?
Right.
For the podcast?
I think we're a little bit different than most other podcasters. Most other podcasters, that's what they do. They're podcasters, whereas I've been doing MyMac.com since 1995. So the podcast is kind of in addition to the website. It's not really the focus of the website. For every one person that listens to the podcast, we probably get 1,000 people that are reading their content online, the articles and the reviews and that sort of thing. So
right,
it's a little bit different, but it's still we're all serving the Mac community as best we can.
Yeah,
that's what we try and do. Just help people out, right?
That's exactly what I try to do. Speaking of which, how long have you been using a Mac now, Adam?
Well, actually, you got to say how long have I been using an app?
An Apple Mac.
Just an Apple computer, because I started out with a Apple 2GS. Actually, even before that, my friends all had Apple 2Cs and Apple 2Es, and that's kind of how I got my indoctrination into the world of Apple. The funny thing is that we were into, you know, the Apple 2s. So, you know, in early history, there's this whole... battle between the Apple II team and the Mac team when Steve Jobs started developing the Mac, and Wozniak kind of headed up the Mac II group, right?
The Apple II group.
The Apple II group. And, you know, this was the way it was at my house, because my dad was a graphic artist, and we were getting ready to buy our first computer, and he really wanted to buy a Mac Plus. And I looked at him and said, "But Dad, I don't know how to deal with that. I can't program it. It's got this weird graphic interface. You know, I don't want that. I want," because we were taking Apple IIe's and we were writing our own basic programs and stuff like that. And the Mac was just this whole foreign thing.
Right.
And actually, one of my friends' dad bought a Mac, and we all kind of laughed at him because we couldn't share our 5 1/4 inch floppy. It had that weird 3.5 inch floppy drive. You know, and lo and behold, I realize now I made the wrong decision. I wish
my computer
had been a Mac. So.
I don't know. I think they probably gave you a better understanding of the technology and computing in general to start with a command line interface rather than a point and click interface. I mean, it was an easier jump for you to get into computers that used a GUI you started with command line, I would think.
That's true. But the first computer we ended up actually buying that I made, you know, my dad buy, it was half the price of a Mac, though, so he saved some money, was this Apple IIgs. And the big thing about the Apple IIgs was it had color graphics, it had a desktop, it had, a GUI, and so it was kind of like the big leap for the Apple IIs, and actually turned out to be the death of the Apple IIs.
It was, but when you look back, though, I was just going to say, honestly, at the time, not knowing that the Mac would become the de facto standard for Apple, and it would literally change the computing history of every company that wanted to make computers, but at the time, that probably was a better decision to buy the 2GS. It was more powerful as far as all the software that you can get for it. At the time, the Mac software was anemic. There was almost nothing. But a lot of Mac users nowadays don't realize the success that Apple had with the Apple II. I mean, it was just... It started this entire industry that we're still talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing.
They were kind of the first mass consumer computer, you computer in the home. People didn't have computers in their home up until then. You know, IBM tried to do it, but Apple really just cornered the market by making it friendly, and that was a conscious decision. I did a episode of my show with Victor Cahiao where we talked about some of the design history, and a big part of that design history and something that Steve Jobs brought in was he wanted to build an appliance. That's why the Mac had the plastics that it had in the case, didn't have metal case, it looked a certain way. He wanted it to look like any other appliance you would have in your house. So,
do you think that the computers nowadays have reached that lofty goal, that they are simply appliances?
No, actually, oddly enough, I don't think we're quite there yet. But I mean, they're an appliance in terms of a personal computer,
right?
Which is just mm-hmm. another appliance in your house, if you want to look at that. But in terms of just what you would think of as a general appliance or device.
Right.
You know,
it's not a microwave. There. It's not a toaster. It's
not that simplified yet. I think it's still a bit esoteric to the mass world. Many people understand it, and as more and more kids are growing up with computers, it's becoming more and more commonplace. But I think there's still a generation out there, a couple generations out there, that still the computer's not.
My parents. There's no way my parents will ever buy a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of glad, because I don't want to spend that much time at my parents' house trying to show them, no, you have to double-click this one, but you only have to single-click that one.
But they might, they really might end up with one, because I do think, we're seeing Apple TV, Windows has their media center, PCs. I do think you're going to see a convergence of the television, and most people have a television. So when there's more and more computer functionality in this device that sits in your living room, whether we're going to call it a computer or a TV or some sort of hybrid thing, that's what Apple's trying to do with Apple TV and all that stuff. So, I think we are getting to that point where it's going to be this general appliance, and it's just kind of just runs. And it might be a slimmed down operating system. It might be less functionality. But I could see a device sitting in the living room that is your entertainment center, as well as where you get your email and where you surf the internet. And IPTV along with your regular, cable TV mm-hmm. on the same box.
They do have a DVR, and that is, it's running Linux, so that is a computer in the living room, and it is dumbed down. Of course, I get a call from her every 60 days or so because it doesn't work anymore, and that's because she still hasn't figured out how to delete something after she's recorded it. So,
like a TiVo or a Replay TV?
It's from Comcast. Yeah. It runs. Yeah, yeah. But it's got if you request the manual, it does have the Creative Commons license in the very back of it. So I thought, and I read into it, and yeah, sure enough, it's running a flavor of Linux. So you started the MacCast in December 2004. Why did you start the MacCast?
Well, because it was the early days of podcasting, and I'm probably like you, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess it might be the same reason you started your show, was I was kind of listening to podcasts, and there were a few technology podcasts out there, but I'm a huge Mac fan, so I was like, well, where's the Mac podcasts?
Yep.
And there wasn't a ton of them out there. There were a couple radio shows, internet radio shows, that were being pushed out as podcasts, and I was looking for something a little bit different. They were kind of long format, a little longer format. I was looking for something that would deliver me in a short format, like 10 or 15 minutes, just the news headlines for the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually how the MacCast started out. I did like a 10-minute show, and it was just a rundown of all the news stories that were up on all of the Mac websites, just to kind of summarize it for people, because I saw it as an opportunity for me to save time. I was driving into work. I had an hour commute, get into work, and I'd be on all the Mac sites getting up to date on my Mac news. I thought, well, if I could just listen to it, you know, get the information in an audio format while I'm driving on my commute, that saves me time. I'm done. And that wasn't out there, and so I decided, well, I'll create it, because if I want it, I'm sure there's other people out there that want it. And that kind of was the birth of it. But then it changed really, really quickly. Obviously now, I mean, now my show is anywhere between 40 minutes and an hour, and we still do the news stuff, but there's a lot of other podcasts that cover that aspect in the short format. And so I try and now inject my own opinions and personality. And it's become more of what I call a community podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big advocate for Mac user groups. I think they're still a great resource to meet like-minded people and share ideas. So I started getting feedback from people, and I realized this was kind of like the experience I had at a user group, where you'd have a dilemma or find out a piece of software that you'd go share with someone. I was able to share that through my podcast globally and get feedback, and someone come back and suggest a different program that maybe I wasn't aware of, or a different solution to a problem. And so this exchange of ideas. So that's become kind of the meat of the MacCast, is people, you know, will write in or send me a comment, and we'll use that as a launching point to go deeper into a subject.
And I've really got to congratulate you, Adam, because I enjoy listening to the MacCast, and you do a great job of filling up 40 minutes to an hour by yourself, which is something that I don't think I would ever take on. I don't think I can just go on that long about any particular subject.
When I started the My Mac podcast, I tried to do it alone for the first, I don't know, half dozen shows or so, but it was really apparent to me, at any rate, that I needed somebody else to be able to bounce ideas and thoughts, and someone to keep me in check, and that's what I kind of hit Chad up for. But Adam, you do it all by yourself. It's how much of the MacCast do you actually script out? And how much of it do you just you sit down and you just do it?
It's all pre-planned. I do a lot of prep. Actually, that's probably a larger portion of the time I put into the show. But again, it's not alone, because yes, it's alone in terms of it's my voice out there. But I also cut in audio comments when I get them, and I encourage people to send them in. But I mean, all of the content is really driven by the audience, which I think is what's making it work for people, and what keeps people's interest. Because yeah, I have certain things that I want to talk about, and I'll kind of comment on the news items that are out there, but really I rely on the audience to send me an email, and someone will ask me a question or say, you know what, here's a good example. Someone just told me about an airport problem they're having with the Core 2 Duo Max, and pointed me to a discussion thread on Apple's forum with the MacBook Pro Core 2 Duos. I never would have found that, because I don't own a MacBook Pro Core 2 Duo, but by them giving me that little bit of information, I was able to go do some research and talk about it as a segment on the show. So, I mean, the content is really, I always have more content than I can even put out, which is a good position to be in. So, you know, I think that's what's making it work. But it really isn't alone, and I do a lot of prep. So I have show notes. I just do an outline. I try not to script it too much, because I don't want it to sound too canned.
Sure.
But do a lot of research into a lot of different topics. And that's what's, again, going back to this, the idea of the user group, is that's how I get more knowledgeable. You know, it forces me to go out and research a lot of this stuff, because someone will ask me about something I had no idea about, or point out a piece of software. Another great example from my last show is somebody asked me about a flashcard application for OS X. They wanted to do simple flashcards, and I found a great application by, you know, doing a quick Google search called iFlash, and I had no idea that piece of software existed out there. So it's great for me too. I mean, I get to discover things, and then I get to share those discoveries with other people, and it just reaches this large audience, which that's what keeps me podcasting, and that's why I love doing doing the show that I do, and I'm sure you guys get a lot of the same stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Did it surprise you how open other Mac podcasters are to talk to you, to help you out? You help them out. I mean, yes, all the different podcasts are kind of competitors in some respects, but to me it seems like it's just kind of a big community. We're all doing our own little thing, but yet we're all so nice to each other. Everybody gets along. There's no... I'm not going to fire up macOS Ken and hear him talking SmackDown about Adam again. I mean, that doesn't happen.
Right.
Everybody's friends. Right. Did that kind of surprise you? Did you think that it'd be a lot more competitive by this point?
You know what? Not really, because we're Mac people. And again, I've been so active with Mac user groups that I just know the mentality of a Mac owner is, in general, I mean, we're generalizing here, but it's just, it really is an open community that shares ideas. And the other thing about it is, because this seems to be coming up a lot. Well, two things, okay? One is, as far as I know, there's not a lot, anybody really making a lot of money off podcasting yet.
So oh, yeah, I just bought a new house because of it, and a car.
maybe when the money starts coming into it, that'll change. I really hope not, and I don't think it will, because I think there's plenty of that to go around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
The other thing is when you're into a subject and you're passionate about a subject, and most Mac owners are very passionate about their Macs, they want to consume as much content related to the Mac as they possibly can. You look at all of the Mac websites that are out there, you know, there's three or four different rumor websites that I read. There's probably five or six, seven, eight, I'd have to go through my RSS feed, but maybe a dozen news websites that I go and read every day. So I look at the podcast as the same way. I mean, there is a time limiting factor with audio. You can only kind of listen to so much. You know,
there's definitely a commitment. There's a commitment involved in listening to podcasting and subscribing to them. Than there is just reading a quick article or review on a website. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I think going back to your question about, you know, does it surprise me there's no competition? I think no, because there's, you know, everybody has different tastes, and a lot of people want to consume a lot of content. I personally subscribe to four or five different Mac-related podcasts. I might not get to listen to all of them every time, but I definitely want that content, and I think there's room for everybody. So I think all those things kind of add to the camaraderie that Mac podcasters have, and I don't see that changing anything.
Doesn't it bother you when you go and you're like, oh, I haven't listened to this, and you just have to delete a couple episodes, even though you haven't listened to them yet, you're like, I'm just too far behind, I'm just going to delete these, and I'll just listen to the newest one. Does that bother you? Because it bothers me. I feel like I let someone down.
I cringe, but that, you know, it's like that. It's, you got to play that catch up thing. The funny thing is, you know, some of the podcasts I listen to are news podcasts, and they're dated, you know, in terms of the content. But yeah, I'll actually go back and listen to an episode that might be 2 weeks old, and I still discover stuff that either I missed or get a different perspective on a news story that I might not have thought about. So that's great, too. I find that is always surprising when that happens.
Don't you think the whole time shift component of podcasting takes some of the competitiveness out of the actual market itself, though?
Yeah, we're not broadcasting at the same time.
We're not competing for a time slot.
Right. It's not you have to listen to the MacCast or Twit or whatever. You can listen to it when you want, how you want.
That's a very good point. I didn't even think about that. But, yeah, you're absolutely right. That certainly factors into it.
What do you think the Apple TV is going? I almost said ITV, and I have to stop doing that. I know Adam has the same problem, because I do listen to the Madcast. Yeah. What do you think the Apple TV is going to do? I almost did it again.
Yeah,
two times in a row. It's just because I'm a tard. What do you think the Apple TV is going to do for podcasters? Do you think it's going to maybe enhance it for us? Or do you think we're going to have to move into some video if we really want to try to move into the living room with Apple?
You know, it supports audio. Obviously, it supports audio podcasting. I'm not so certain how many people do that. I mean, I can get podcasts on my TiVo, and I don't do that. You know, audio podcasts. If I could get video podcasts, which I don't think TiVo supports, oddly enough, then I think that would be something I'm interested in. So I kind of see the Apple TV as being a big boon for a lot of the video podcasts. You know, I think it's going to jump some of their numbers. I don't think it'll be as big a leap as we had when, you know, iTunes 4.9 came out and they added support for podcasting. That was a huge revolution for podcasting and audio podcasting. And I hope we have another thing like that come out, but I don't think the Apple TV is going to be it. I do think Apple TV is going to do very well for video podcasters. It was the number one reason I wanted one, and I was just really bummed when I had to cancel my order because I found out that you have to have an HD or an ED TV to actually connect it up. So, and I just have a Sony Vega. Really nice 32-inch TV, but it doesn't support Apple TV, so I was a little bummed about that.
I thought the Apple TV had a standard video out port as well. I thought it was HDMI component and then just standard.
Yeah, so I did a whole Apple TV special.
Yeah, I know. I listened to it. That was a serve.
Oh, okay, softball. Yeah, so essentially, you know then, and maybe for anybody in your audience who hadn't heard that, it does have the component out, but I guess there's two types of component out. There is you can get progressive signal or interlaced signal, standard definition television, anything that's not EDTV or HDTV only supports interlaced 480i signal, and the minimum requirement for the Apple TV is a 480p progressive scan. So essentially, where it draws every line on the TV screen versus every other line, which is what interlaced is. So
for all you out there who have a standard television, it may be time to upgrade soon if you want to take advantage of the Apple TV. I know that I'm kind of fortunate there that I do have an HDTV, so I'll be okay, and I'm definitely buying an Apple TV. But there's just a lot of people that don't.
And like me.
Yeah.
Like Chad.
I really question Apple's decision on that. I'm trying to figure out why, and somebody asked me the question. They said, do you know why? Is it a technical limitation?
No.
Why did Apple choose to make that the cutoff point? I have no idea. I don't know what the rationale was, especially considering that they don't even sell any any HD content on iTunes yet.
I think the only explanation is forward thinking on Apple's part, so that when they do start selling HD content and someone buys it, the Apple TV, they know for a fact, will be able to play it. Although it's still only a 40 gig hard drive. I personally think Apple is going to have to open up that architecture on the Apple TV to really make it successful.
Yeah, the only thing I can think of is maybe there was a bigger cost associated with putting in a downsampler to do the interlaced signal. I don't know. It had to be a financial decision.
It's
in my mind, because you could still support both. You would just downsample the content
the
for
HD
a standard
content.
Def TV. Yeah. I think you can actually buy a downsampler, but it is very expensive. Somebody sent me the link to one, and it's like $385. So I told them, I said, well,
what's the point?
So it'd be $385 for that and $300 for the Apple TV, I'm paying $685. Why don't I just buy a Mac Mini at that point and connect that up?
Yep.
And we go into that in that episode of the MacCast too. For anybody who has a standard def TV, you might want to seriously consider looking at a Mac Mini if you want to get that kind of connectivity in your living room.
So Steve Jobs is in trouble once again with the whole stock scandal, this time with Pixar. And of course, it's still not settled with Apple. A lot of people think that because Apple released their report basically absolving Steve Jobs of any wrongdoing, that that's the end of it. Well, the feds still have something to say about it. And they're also looking to Pixar, and it's looking more and more like there may be something to the story. One of the things that Adam and Chad and I were talking about before we started the show was, what would happen if Steve Jobs was forced to leave Apple? Who would fill in? Who would become the CEO? What do you think, Adam?
Right. I covered this a little bit on my last show, and the rumor I've heard is that Dr. Eric Schmidt, who is the CEO of Google and is on Apple's board of directors, is being prepped and ready to sort of step in as a temporary CEO. He obviously wouldn't be CEO of two companies, but we'd be back to those days of the, I think you said it, the iCEO, like we had with Steve Jobs before he actually officially came back to Apple when he was doing Pixar and Apple. And it's just the strange thing about this story in my mind is Apple did say, Steve Jobs hasn't done anything wrong, yet here it crops up that there's some questions about what was going on at Pixar while he was there as well. And it just makes you scratch your head and go, what, really? Come on. Honestly, do these CEOs really have no idea what's going on? Or, are they just playing the protection game because, they got caught?
I would have to wonder, it really comes down to that backdating stock is not illegal as long as the board has approved in a public company. But what would be the most benefit to the stockholders, to the shareholders? Would it be to punish Steve Jobs, to remove him as CEO of Apple Computer, or leave him there? I don't think that any stockholder, shareholder would benefit for Steve Jobs leaving Apple. Yeah. I think that would probably be the worst thing that could happen.
I think if you ask the stockholders, they would say, no way, we want him to stay no matter what. But like you said, it might not be the stockholders that really have something to say about it. It's going to be the government.
Well, that's only if he's convicted of a federal crime, because as a convicted felon, at least in the United States, you cannot be the CEO of a publicly traded company. That's why Martha Stewart isn't the CEO of her company anymore, because she's a convicted felon.
Right.
But right. I was saying, I don't know if it's a coincidence that all this is happening now and Steve Jobs is... there's this fear of Steve Jobs possibly losing control of Apple, leaving Apple, I should say, and Bill Gates retiring from Microsoft.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
Wouldn't that just blow people's mind if Bill Gates came out of retirement and became the CEO of Apple Computers? Could you just imagine the keynotes with Bill Gates up there? We've got something really special. And just one more thing. Oh, my God. He'd probably open with, just one more thing. They'd be, oh, no, Bill, that goes at the end. At the end of the presentation.
No, I don't relish that day. I hope that never happens. But, I mean, that's almost as shocking as saying, you know, that Apple was going to use Intel processors. But that happened, so.
Yeah, now looking back, it's been over a year. That Apple completely made the transition. You know, they started about this time last year. They released the first iMac that had the Intel chip in it. Now it's a year later. Obviously, it's been financially successful, but do you think it's good for Mac users now that we are all on Intel?
I think it's extremely good. Just in and of, you know, just simply for the fact that we have things like Parallels and VMware and Boot Camp. You know, as much as I don't want to advocate running Windows, I think it's done a lot for bringing people over to the Mac and actually getting a lot of Windows users who were on the fence to actually seriously consider looking at the Mac, which was always my thing when I was trying to sort of evangelize the Mac and OS X, was just trying to get people to say, just try it, just use it, and you couldn't get them to just use it. And now I think we have a comfort level with these other technologies to say, look, you know what, you can buy a Mac, and if things go really south, you can just run Windows on it. You don't have to worry, right? But we know, being Mac users, that that's not going to happen. So it's just great that we have that opportunity. So I think that's really, really cool. I also, just looking at, you know, I think Steve Jobs and Apple obviously knew a lot of things from Intel in terms of their processor roadmap of where Intel was going, because there was a lot of question about that when the announcement was first made. It seemed like AMD was kind of the golden child of the PC market in terms of processors, and everybody was going, well, why did they pick Intel? Why didn't they pick AMD? And I think if you look at the processor lineup now, with
18 months after they made the announcement, it's clear that Intel was definitely the way to go and not AMD.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then, you know, so then you say, well, what about Motorola, IBM, you know, that they left behind? Well, look at what those guys are doing. They're still languishing, which was the problem Apple always had with them. I think Steve Jobs was really upset about the whole 3 gigahertz deal, where he stood up there and said, we're going to have a 3 gigahertz Mac, and that never happened with a PowerPC. And I think a lot of that blame goes on, you know, those guys.
I think so, IBM was definitely more interested in heavy iron and not desktop. I think that's kind of that's always been their philosophy at IBM, is heavy iron. They really don't care about putting chips on a desktop computer, especially for Apple. Why would they care?
Right. And so, you know, right now it's looking like it was the right decision, especially now. I think I just saw that, didn't Intel come out and demo or show some sort of 80-core processor?
Yeah, they were talking about that on Twit this week.
It's technically a quantum computer at that point. Yeah. It's and of course they're talking it's 5 years away. And that may sound like a long time, but really, that's not that long a time ago. I mean, what were we using in 2002? How fast were our computers compared to what we're using now and going ahead till 2012? I mean, that's not really that long But I just can't imagine having that much power. What do you do with that much power? I mean, already we can already stream live video directly to our laptops and our desktops, and we can already edit video and audio, and what more do we really need? Then again, right. I'm the one that said the iPod would be a failure.
Yeah, I keep asking that question too, you know, and then they keep finding answers for me, which is another one of those things that I love about Apple, right? Because it's like, what am I going to do with all this processing power? And then they give us, you know, iLife with iDVD and iMovie, and I start making my own DVDs and things like that. And encoding is still a problem.
Yeah.
You know, even with, I have the best machine I have for encoding right now is probably my Intel Mac Mini, which is the Core Duo. And it's slow to encode video. So I would welcome anything that can speed up encoding video is good in my mind.
So you went to the Macworld Expo this year. This was your first Macworld Expo?
Yeah, it was actually my very first Macworld. I had never been to a Macworld before. Always had wanted to go, and it just never worked out. Now I had a real big excuse to say I had to go.
That's right. So someone comes up to you and says, Adam, I've never been to a Macworld Expo. Obviously, they wouldn't be a podcaster. They'd just be a citizen Mac user. And they said, should I go? What's your answer?
That is a really good question. I didn't do any of the seminars, you know, so I know there's a lot of stuff there for the average user if they want to take advantage of the seminars. I think if you're a huge Mac fan and you really want to see a keynote one time in your life, that's worth going for, because that was an amazing experience to actually be there live. I mean, it's one thing to see the stream and to, you know, sit there on the text, what I call the text streams,
right?
Mm-hmm. Where you're wishing you were there, and then versus actually being there. You know, like the show floor is the show floor. I mean, you can see a lot of really cool products and upcoming products and stuff like that, and that's kind of fun. You know, some people like getting all the swag. But I would say if you have a reason to take advantage of some of the great sessions and things like that they have there, and you're going to take advantage of that stuff, I would say it's definitely worth going. But if you're just planning on just going to kind of walk the show floor and take in the experience, and you're not going to get to take advantage of the keynote or some of the other things, it might be a hard sell for someone to justify the cost. I could see, you know, if you live in the area, or you can drive there and maybe go for a day.
Then,
or two,
yeah, that's a no-brainer, like that. Then, obviously.
Yeah, but I mean, to fly across country just for the show floor, to walk the show floor, I would say if you're going to do that, also make it a trip maybe to San Francisco or Napa or something like that that you'd always planned on taking, and just do the Macworld thing as almost an aside.
His name is Adam Christensen. He is
the host.
The host of the MacCast. He is definitely a Mac pioneer as far as podcasing is concerned. You should really be listening to the Mac podcast, or the
MacCast.
I'm just having a hell of a time over here, aren't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm a professional podcaster. You should definitely be listening to the MacCast and not the My Mac podcast. So stop listening now, because we're going to stop talking to Adam and go listen to his show. It's much better.
Yeah.
Or stay here and listen to the rest of our show.
I think there's room for us.
Absolutely.
All. I thank you for the opportunity to come on and talk to you guys about.
Well, the
Mac
next time there's some great big huge Mac news going on, it's the whole world is abuzz. We're going to have you on and tell us what
definitely.
We should think about it. Definitely.
What is that? What is the next big thing?
Yeah,
Leopard.
You know,
Leopard.
Yeah, when it's coming out and when it is released, how well it runs.
Well, and maybe the actual final production iPhone.
And maybe a new iPod.
New iPod.
I think is probably bigger than Leopard.
Yeah,
honestly,
yeah.
Especially if it's at all like the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
We can only.
It will be. I'm going to go out on a limb right now and say it will be. I think we're going to see the iPhone without the internet functions. Some people think the internet functions are going to be in there. I think they're still going to leave those out. I think it's just going to be the iPod portion of the iPhone, and I think we'll actually see it before the iPhone launches. So that's my prediction, and I'm wrong 99.9% of the time. So, you know, you
well,
can take
I'll,
that
I will back you up.
Take it.
I'll back you up with one change to your prediction. I think it will be internet enabled, but only to access the iTunes Music Store. So you can buy music through your iPod. And the reason I say this is because there's a new feature in the iPod software now that will let you transfer your purchases from your iPod back to your Mac, back to
That's
iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
Other than your computer dies and you want to transfer your music back from the iPod to the iTunes, and it doesn't transfer your entire library, just your purchased music. So I think that means, to me, that means Apple is going to allow you to buy music on your iPod. And if you buy it on your iPod, how do you get it back to your Mac? That's where that functionality comes in handy. So I agree with you, Adam. I think that the new form factor of the iPod is going to look just like the iPhone.
Yep. Well, we'll come back and talk about it when it happens then,
cool.
I guess.
Well, thanks for joining us, and make sure you guys check out the
MacCast.
Chad's jumping in before I screw it up again. Thanks, Adam. Yeah,
thanks, Adam.
All right, thank you.
We interrupt this program to annoy you and make things generally irritating.
Jolly good, and we're back here with Guy Searle. Hello, Guy.
Well, hello there, Chad. How are you today?
Oh, just ripping.
And you know what this really means is that neither one of us can do an authentic English accent.
Not at all.
Not at all. We sound like crap. And we've probably
offended David Cohen.
Yeah, I know.
He's like,
the entire British Empire.
So, again, thanks to Adam for doing the interview with Chad and I. And now we're
Adam Christensen.
Adam Christensen.
Oh.
And
did I meet him?
The MacCast. Guy's being facetious because he did, in fact, meet Adam Christensen a few times at the Macworld Expo. And every time he did, he'd say, "Hi, I'm Guy Searle."
From the MyMac.com podcast.
And at the last time, Adam said, "Yeah, we've met like three times now." Although, in Guy's defense, the last time was at a bar, and we had been drinking, so.
Yeah.
And we hadn't eaten much yet either, so. So anyways, let's get into the Mac news. What's going on in the Mac world? Does anybody know? I've been so swamped this whole week that, to be honest, I haven't really been following what's going on in the Mac world a whole lot, other than there was a announcement at, who was it now? Somebody. A hidden feature that no one knew about in iChat 4.0 coming out in Leopard, which allows you to use iChat as a voicemail box. So someone can leave you a message in iChat, so the next time you sign into iChat, you've got voice message. That's pretty cool, I think.
And that's only going to be for Leopard?
Yeah, I would imagine. Maybe they'll release a version of iChat for Tiger.
Release the virgins.
Maybe it will come out in Tiger, but I got to imagine that Apple's probably... They want some features in some of their software that's going to entice people. Yeah,
to get Leopard, yep.
Yeah, and let's be honest, every one of us sitting here is going to be upgrading to Leopard within a week of it coming out. I will.
More than likely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I went into the future and already bought it.
Honestly, when Tiger was coming out, and Chad can testify to this, I said it's probably not a good idea to upgrade right away. And my plan was to wait for at least a week or two, check message boards and the web, and make sure that, you know, there was no major problems with Tiger.
And how long did you wait, Tim?
Maybe 12 hours. I went to the Apple Store that week. Or no, I went to CompUSA the next day, and there it was.
Just by
and
coincidence.
There it was. What was I supposed to do? I was hapless. In Apple's power. I must buy Tiger. I can't resist. And I bought it, and, you know. Then I said, after I bought it, I was like, okay, I bought it. That's cool. I've got it. I don't have to worry about that now. I'll just set it on a shelf. And it didn't stay on the shelf for, you know, maybe. It was the
what,
same
six
night.
6 hours?
No, it wasn't even that long, honestly. I mean, I got home, and I put it in, and I couldn't help it. It was just this compulsion. I had to update. I had to upgrade. I had to have Tiger. And, of course, I rationalized it by saying, well, you know, I run MyMac.com. I have to know what's going on. How can I serve my readers if I don't have Tiger?
Self-delusion is a marvelous thing.
It is absolutely marvelous. You got any Mac news over there, Chad? No?
Yeah, we got... this is kind of an interesting one. This is from, today...
Today.
According to travel site Cheap Flights, Apple's working with several airlines to allow passengers to use iPod seat connections, which power and charge their iPods, as well as allowing video content to be displayed on seat back screens.
That would be pretty cool.
Is that going to be an iPod exclusive, or is that just going to be like an aux input?
Well, no, it's got to have to be an iPod if they're going to send video through it, wouldn't they? If it was just audio, sure. But this sounds like it's going to be, you have to have a dot connector if you're going to send video out of the iPod, correct? Mm-hmm. You can't send that out through the headphones.
I don't think that's going to happen because it's, you know, Apple's already in trouble for having a majority share.
Oh, please. They're putting it in cars now. There's dock connectors.
Airlines expected to incorporate the system in 2007 include Emirates, United, U.S. Airlines, Continental, Delta, Air France, and more.
Air France?
Air France.
See, if Air France is in the rumor, come on, you know it's true. has to be.
Well, I heard something about this a couple of weeks ago, and it was a couple of the European airlines that kind of spanked Apple for making or having the announcement because they were saying it was premature that they were just in talks.
I personally, I think that's a good idea. I don't fly very often. I mean, the last two times I flew was to go to Macworld Expo, so it's not like I'm a frequent flyer. That being said, one of the reasons
how long it took you to get there.
Well, yeah,
that would have been like a bonus.
Exactly, because I didn't listen to my iPod in any of the layout for spots because I was there for like 2.5 hours, and I thought, well, if I want to listen to my iPod on the plane, I don't want to listen to it here in the terminal and run the battery out. So I don't know. Yeah. I think it would be. I don't know so much about the displaying it on the back of the chair in front of me. You know, I don't. Yeah. Do I really want everybody around me to sit there and watch whatever
porn
I'm watching?
Yeah.
You know, watching whatever. You know, porn.
Heavy like guys Dallas.
Then again, porn's so much better. You know, on a big screen, not the little handheld. Because really, if you're watching porn and you're holding the iPod,
well, you know, let's drop this part right now.
We do want to find out what you guys are thinks going on in the Mac news. What programs are you, the listener, using? What are you doing with your Mac lately? Is there like a certain program that you see that's really not getting the attention it deserves? And boy, it'd be sure great if more Mac users knew about this and this and this program. If you've got any ideas or suggestions, hey, let us know. We do have a phone number you can call. It is
1-801-938-5559 is our Skype call-in.
Of course, if you are using Skype, you can fire up Skype and send me a message, and it's mymac.com, right? Yep. That's my Skype, right?
mymac.com. Yes, that is
and
your
and Skype. It is a dot. It's not D-O-T. It's mymac.com. So just add me to your Skype list and send it over, and hey, we'll put it on the show.
Yep.
That's just the kind of guy we are.
Hey.
Hey.
We're here to help you, to help me, to help you.
Well, we've also got security updates right now. Apple's released multiple security updates.
And, of course, Microsoft always gets a big ribbing about, you know, it's so insecure. But Apple has to release security updates, too, because no computer platform is completely secure.
Yep.
So if you're on a Mac, and chances are you are, it's a good idea to update the security updates. There's a reason Apple releases those, and it's highly recommended.
Yep.
Anybody got any new software that they've downloaded, tried, they played with? Guy, Chad, anything? Nothing?
I've been playing around, and it's just the demo version of Ambrosia Software's Redline.
Oh, I saw that. I haven't tried it yet. What do you think?
It's okay. The preview version they give you doesn't have all that many cars unlocked.
Why don't you explain what that is?
Well, what Redline is, it's a car racing game, and if you have the full version, apparently you can. They have like the wide open tracks where you're cross country racing. In the preview version, all you get are a couple of circular kind of what do you call that kind of race? It's not an oval. It's
figure eight.
No, it's not a figure eight.
Oh, it's like a Grand Prix style?
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha.
Grand Prix style. And, and I'm using it here on a 24-inch iMac, Intel iMac, and it looks pretty good. And it's relatively cheap. It's like $25.
Hmm. Well, worth checking out. It's got a demo, too, you said, right?
Yes, it does. That's at ambrosia.com.
How important do you guys think it is for companies to release robust demos of their programs, be it a game or a graphic converting program or whatever it happens to be, how important do you think a demo is in your purchasing decision? Do you, will you try a demo before you buy it? Or if you just read a review somewhere that says this is fantastic, is that enough for you?
Oh, it depends.
For my computer, I definitely want a demo for the most part. I'd like to be able to play with it, see how easy it is to use, and see if it's something I actually want.
Guy?
That's going to kind of depend on what kind of program it is. For games and stuff, I like to have a demo just so, you know, I can decide whether or not this is something I want to spend any time with. For things along the lines of being productive, you know, I mean, I'm doing Final Cut Express, I'm doing the iLife stuff, and you're pretty much, you don't really need a demo for it because you're going to go out and get it anyway.
Should demos be crippleware, i.e., you know, you can only use it for 5 minutes, or it puts a watermark in it, whether, you know, a watermark in your graphic work or a podcast or whatever it happens to be. It puts that watermark in there, so you can't really use it professionally, but it gives you an idea. Or should it be a fully functional, completely unlocked demo that lasts for a certain amount of time, say 15 days, and then it will not work again until you license it? Which do you prefer?
I prefer the time component. I like to actually be able to see what I'm creating and get some use out of it, even though it may be only for a limited term. At least I can test all the functionality and get an idea of what I'm actually may purchase. So,
mm-hmm. Guy?
Yeah, I would agree with Chad. I like having a certain amount of time with all the features available. There's one other type of kind of demo that you guys haven't hit on, and that's the one where you can't actually save the work.
Right, I hate those.
Those are horrible.
You know, that's no better than watching a video of the program working online. I mean, go to the developer site and watch a video and, oh, this is how it works. You're saving me the trouble of clicking myself and doing it when I can't save anything I'm doing. So that's the worst kind as far as I'm concerned. I absolutely cannot stand, oh, you can't save it. It's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if it's just graphics, you can always take a screen snapshot. That was a limitation I got around with an early version of Photoshop that I was using that you couldn't save. So I would just take a screen snapshot of whatever I was doing. Didn't save layers or anything, but I was still using the program, so I was happy. You know, coming from a developer's point of view, if they give you a time limit, say you can use it for free for 15 days, completely unlocked, all the features are there, a lot of people only need it for one project only. So even though it's like a $12.99 program, they're going to download it, use it for that one time, and that's it. And they're never going to pay for it. And so they got to use your software for free, and you never got compensated for that, even if they used it for a commercial purpose. Say an iMovie plugin, something like that. So, but, you know, for the most part, though, I think that it's the smart developers will let you use it completely free, completely unlocked for a certain amount of time, and then it locks itself down. Of course, there's also software, shareware, that will allow you to always use it and simply pop up with those annoying reminder messages every single time you use it.
Hey, yo, pay for me.
Hey, you know, this took a long time to develop. It might be nice if you, I don't know, contributed to my child's college fund by spending the $5 that obviously is worth it because you keep opening this program and you keep seeing these warning messages.
Yeah, you get that a lot with some of the Freeverse stuff.
Yeah, and that's completely valid to me too. Did you guys check out my anybody that listens to this podcast for any length of time knows that I'm a gamer. I created a Steve Jobs Me, which is a playable character in the Nintendo Wii. Did you think it kind of looked like Steve Jobs, or was I way off the mark? I thought I got the eyebrows good.
Yeah, but it also, you know, God forbid, it also reminded me of, in a way, of Bill Gates.
Yeah, it's good to do the same thing.
Bill Gates?
Yeah.
Maybe I was having some kind of weird acid flashback from the 60s, and I made Bill Gates. I wasn't born in the 60s, but maybe my mom was on acid in the 60s, and it's kind of inherited or something.
I know nothing about that.
We got a lot of content up at mymac.com right now. We're actually going to have more by the time this podcast is released, because we record this podcast a good 5 days before it actually hits the net. That allows me to take out all the curse words that Chad is constantly dropping that nobody ever hears. And I just...
F-bombs
all over the place. And, oh, it's horrible.
I'm glad you got my back, Tim.
Klaus Wolf, our counterpart in Germany.
Our correspondent in Germany.
our Berlin correspondent.
Yeah, yes. Did a review of Keyword Manager. It's it's a pretty cool program.
It allows you to put the
metadata, i.e. you can name pictures, this is so-and-so's birthday, within iPhoto, and it does it really well. It looks like it does some batch work.
Well, you know, if you look at the screen captures he did, it looks like a iPhoto function.
Yeah, it looks like a part of iPhoto.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I'm going to have to take a look at. Bakari's got a couple reviews up. One is Create a Digital Workflow for iPhoto Book,
mm-hmm.
and the other is A Guide to Digital Photography. So, good stuff there. Donnie has returned with another thumbnails. I'm going to make an announcement here,
mm-hmm.
even though everybody listening to this won't be able to download it yet. We are returning with our ebooks. We call them scroll down books because you have to scroll down to read mm-hmm. instead of just turning a page. I know it's incredibly clever. and the first of the new breed, other than the free Chris Siebold collection that I released a couple months back, we're releasing the first 50 Maxpirations of Donnie's. It's going to be a completely free ebook that you can download. It's almost 200 pages. It's got some thumbnails in it. Donnie's articles, his how-to articles, when you read them separately, you get up there and you read it, you look at the pictures, 5 minutes, right?
Yep.
I mean, they're not super long. They're to the point.
Mm-hmm.
They impart their knowledge to you, and you're done. But I didn't realize the body of work that he's done. I collected the first 50 in some of his thumbnail comics.
Yep.
And, oh, my God.
Are you including the thumbnail comics in this one, or is it just
Yes, no. It's all the Maxpirations, the first 50, I should say. And it's also going to include some of his thumbnails, not all of them, just some of them. Because some of his articles would, like, end on half the page, and I didn't want to...
Right.
It's a big white spot to the next page started, so I'd put a thumbnail in there, and it worked out really well. And cool. Donnie and I have been working on this ebook together for a little while now, and we're just about ready to release it to the public. So you'll be able to download it. If you enjoy it and you think it was worth it, there is a donate button in it. You just click. It'll take you to a web page, and you can donate to Donnie's Children's College Fund.
Yep.
But there's also going to be a way that if you really enjoy this... Don't step on that, Chad. You're going to mess up my mic.
Sorry.
If you really enjoy it, you're going to be able to buy a hardcover book of this through Lulu. So this is going to be a printed book.
Mm-hmm.
As well, and it's print on demand, and I think that's the future of publishing.
Yeah.
But this is going to be a free book. We are going to have a second book coming out from another author, and I'm going to hold back on who that's going to be. That one won't be a free book. That will cost you money, but it's going to be worth every penny, trust me. And I don't say that just because I get a cut, but I say that because it's going to be a really fantastic mm-hmm. ebook. So keep an eye on MyMac.com here in the real near future, and make sure you check out Maxpirations, the first 50. It's well worth the download. It's going to be a PDF,
certainly.
Free of charge. You guys won't have to pay a dime for it. You know, because this is content that you can get free anyways on our website. Of course, it's going to be click, 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 going through Donnie's archives to read mm-hmm. each and every one. It would just be a huge pain. This way, it's downloadable to your computer. You could print it if you want. It's almost 200 pages. I give you that warning ahead of time. And if you print it on a color printer, it's going to take a lot of color because, you know, this is...
A lot of ink.
A lot of ink. But it's free. What more could you want? And mm-hmm. if you read that whole thing, if you're relatively new to the Mac, this is going to be something I think you're going to want. And you can't beat
Donnie
the price.
Donnie has got some amazing content with
I think so.
Yep.
And right now, by the time anybody hears this... We'll almost be releasing Maxpiration 73. So it's not going to be too much more before we release another volume of the Maxpiration mm-hmm. series. And I am looking at some of our older content and our archive stuff that we're going to turn into ebooks as well. So we're going to have more collections that people can download. It's PDF, so you know you can
yep.
Mac or PC or Linux for that matter. You can
yeah, view
it anywhere.
Anyone can read a PDF.
Yep. That's going to...
Who's printing that for us?
Lulu is going to do the actual printing.
Okay.
Lulu is kind of a self-publishing. You send them the PDF file as long as it meets their standards, you know, how it has to be laid out. They can print out the book and ship it to anybody. So when someone orders from Lulu, Donnie will get a cut of that.
Yep.
There's a set fee that Lulu will charge every time that book is ordered. Donnie can go in and charge anything of, you know, let's say it's $15. Donnie can go in and say the book's $20.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
$5 from every sale will go directly to him. So that's fantastic.
Yep.
Donnie doesn't do this for the money. Don't get us wrong, but I think this is a valuable resource for new Mac users to be able to download or buy hardcover, yep, and have this knowledge right there. It will teach you how to use your Mac and the applications that come with your Mac much more efficiently. It's really good work, and I think you guys will enjoy it. So we didn't have Guy too long on the show, and we're quickly running out of time. I did want to say that we are broadcasting live from the Apple Store on March 10th, 2007. If you are anywhere in the West Michigan area, Chad and I would love to have you up in the Grand Rapids Woodland Mall Apple Store.
We will be there from 2 to 3:30.
And we just have a ton of stuff to give away.
Yep.
Either next week or the week after, we're going to go through a complete list of everything we have. But just off the top of my head, we've got a lot of stuff from Mac sales, from Otherworld Computing. We've got some external hard drives. We even got some T-shirts. We're going to give some T-shirts away. That'll be fun. We do have Microsoft Office. We do have a couple keyboards, the wireless desktop.
Two copies of Office.
Two copies of Microsoft Office, yep. Mm-hmm. Two of the wireless desktop laser mouse and keyboard. There's just going to be so much stuff. Roxio Toast, the brand new version that just came out. See, I said version that time, by the way. it's just a lot of really cool stuff. We've got at least six or seven books that we're going to give away. We didn't give books away at all last time, so... We're going to have books on iBooks and iMacs and GarageBand. We're going to give those away. All told, right now we're sitting at over $2,500, $2,500 worth of merchandise to give away. If you wanted to go buy everything that we're giving away, there's no way.
Yeah.
It would cost you more than a couple iBooks, well, MacBooks, I should say.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Leopard coming out with a new backup utility to be able to archive and automatically back up, everybody listening to this is going to need a hard drive. Going to. And we're going to have at least two to three of them to give away. So that's, in fact, I think we have three. So, yeah, I mean, it's
those
free.
Those coming from OWC.
Otherworld Computing. Check out MacSales.com. And we will, I'm going to take some pictures here in the next couple weeks as we get closer to the event of all the free stuff that we have to give away. I think that will get people a little bit more excited. But you don't have to be at the event to get something for free. We do have a home version of the show. All you have to do is send an email to contest@mymac.com. In the body of the message, put your name, address, and phone number. And while Chad and I are actually giving stuff away at the Apple Store as part of our Apple quiz, that's how we're giving stuff away, we're going to randomly select a couple of people from our home audience who is going to get some free stuff. I can't tell you what they're going to get yet, but it's going to be cool. So.
So make sure you get your entry in to Tim, and we
as quickly as possible.
Yeah, and you may be a winner.
You may be a winner in the home version of
it. That's right.
It sucks. I'm not going to be there.
Yeah. Well, you know, stuff happens.
Yeah, you know,
you were there last time and Chad wasn't, so maybe it's fire. And then next
still
time,
thinking about driving it.
Oh God, that would be horrible. Not for us, but I mean for you, that'd be a long drive.
Well, I actually did Google mapped it, and it's like 10 to 11 hours.
Wow, that would be brutal.
Well, I've done it before.
Does it sound like he's trying to talk himself into it there, Chad?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, no.
Let's talk to Miss Searle and see what she thinks of the matter.
I'm sorry. Miss Searle isn't available. May I take a message?
I got to go to Walmart. Be back in 2 days.
3 days.
We do have one bit of unfinished business from last week. Guy Searle, if he's prepared. I don't know if he is, and I didn't prepare him for this. He was going to talk about a podcast that he's going to be doing, possibly with the aforementioned Donnie Yankolo.
Yeah.
What's going on with
that? Maybe Russ Walkowicz as well.
Oh, maybe Russ Walkowicz. Ooh.
Sweet.
Yeah, I got an email from Nemo saying, well, you know, Russ is in your area, too.
Absolutely.
Like, oh, that's right. That's right.
That's it, yeah.
So Russ and Donnie, it's going to be next month, and I can't find my freaking calendar.
It's the
third Saturday in March.
Do a search for iCal.
iCal should be right up here on my desktop, and I don't see it.
No, I mean do a spotlight. Just type in iCal; it'll be the first one. You drop down with your arrow key and hit enter, and like magic, it will pop up on your screen. I know it's amazing. It is. Isn't that amazing?
I am amazed.
Only Apple technology, I tell you. So it would be the third.
March 24th. Actually, it's the fourth Saturday. March 24th.
March 24th. Where?
At the Luther Jackson Middle School at 3020 Gallows Road in Falls Church, Virginia. Starting at 9:30, going to 12:30. I don't know how long my part of it will be because, of course, you know, it is the general meeting for the Washington Apple Pie.
And,
so
and this
they'll
will
be doing other stuff too.
This will be an official MyMac.com podcast. When we have more details, maybe a Google map of it or something, I don't know, we will make a big posting up on the website at least a week or two ahead of time. And if we can work it out, maybe we can get some free goodies for you guys to take with you up there, Guy.
Oh, man, they would love it, and I would too.
We will, well, it won't be for you, you schmuck. It'll be for the people.
We're doing this for the fans, man.
It's for the fans, man.
I actually have to give them the stuff?
That's right. That's kind of part of the deal. Well, we're at an hour, and we still have at least three segments to go, so we need to wrap this up before we're into Mac Mini podcast again.
Territory.
Yeah, so.
All right.
We are out of here, and up next is David Cohen, and then we've got, John Nemo's got an interview with Robin Williams, one of my favorite Mac authors. She's great, so stick around, listen to that, and we'd love to hear any feedback from you. Send it to tim@mymac.com, and I'll share it with Guy and Chad, maybe, and, you know, a good joke about those two guys. We'll keep it between ourselves. See everybody later. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Bye.
I apologize for that, but I think you'll find this a bit more interesting.
Hello, my name is David Cohen, and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, my guide to using a Mac in a Windows world. Welcome to Fenestration number 24. This Fenestration segment is going to step slightly on John Nemo's toes and do a book review. The book in question is one of the Take Control series from Tidbits Publishing, the publishers of the Tidbits Macintosh email list. And the title is Take Control of Running Windows on a Mac 2nd Edition by Joe Kissel. It's available at the very reasonable price of $10 as an ebook, a PDF download, or in print at $19.99. This is the second edition of the book, and was updated in mid-December 2006, in other words, about 6-7 weeks ago. But as regular listeners to Fenestrations will know, the issue of running Windows on Intel Macs is a very fast-moving market. Consequently, the book is very slightly out of date, but you shouldn't let this put you off. The author is a Mac journalist of 10 years standing, and is also part of the editorial team for the Tidbits mailing list itself. And his experience in helping users out with their problems really shows in this book. It's very clearly written, everything is laid out in the correct order and a correct manner, and really helps you on to understand the pros and cons of everything he's talking about. There are chapters that discuss why you might want to run Windows applications in the first place, and then it moves on to discuss the various ways of running Windows on an Intel Mac, namely direct running via bootcamp, virtualization using Parallels, or emulation using a free product called Q. There are then comprehensive sections covering the details of installing Windows using each of these three methods, together with the pros and cons of each approach, and considerations for some oddities and particular things you might have to think about while you're doing it. Everything is very clearly laid out, and there are plenty of screenshots and sidebars and little box-outs explaining the various facets of the installation and getting things up and running. Following that, there's a comprehensive section covering security under Windows, which Mac users may not be completely familiar with. So it talks about how you might want to set up a firewall, configure Internet Explorer or another browser for browsing the Internet, and various things for anti-spam and anti-malware. To really round things out, there's also a section discussing how you can take a standard Windows XP installation disk and slipstream Service Pack 2 into it. This is a process where if you have a standalone Service Pack 2, you can incorporate it into the original Windows installation, so you don't need to install Service Pack 2 after you've installed Windows XP. They effectively get installed together. This is a real time saver. To really round off the entire package, they also incorporate a voucher that allows you to get $10 off a copy of Parallels. I really can't recommend this book highly enough. It's very clear and easy to read, and really acts as a one-stop shop towards the issues around installing Windows on an Intel Mac. Most of the information is probably available elsewhere on the internet, but not in one place, and so the fact that it's all brought together in such a clear and concise style to me means that it's a really strong proposition. Now, as I mentioned before, the book has been updated recently, so it probably will be a while before it's updated again. There is talk on the Tidbits website about possibly it being updated to incorporate more about Windows Vista, now that Vista's been released, but they don't currently have any timescales or ideas about when that might happen. The other thing is that the book is very much focused on Intel Macintoshes only. There is a single page that talks about options for PowerPC Macs, but really it is only a single page and is not really worthwhile buying the book just for that if you've got a PowerPC Mac, unless you're planning to upgrade to an Intel Mac in the near future. And finally, the book does assume a certain knowledge of Windows. If you've never used Windows before and you are looking to buy this book, I would recommend getting hold of a book that introduces you to some of the idiosyncrasies of operating in a Windows environment. David Avery of MyMac.com previously reviewed this book for the website and gave it a hearty 5 out of 5 rating. I can certainly endorse that view with the revised version as well.
That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Hello, Robert Hazelrig. I've got a couple of educational titles here to review for you. First up is eMedia's Essential Acoustic Guitar. This software is available on DVD. It'll play in your computer or on your DVD player. It's available in English and Spanish, and it retails for about $20. The lesson progresses more or less like a PowerPoint slideshow with some intermittent video tutorials throughout. The software is designed for beginners and includes 46 lessons. Also included in the package is a URL to some bonus downloadable toolkits, including a metronome, a digital recorder, and a chord dictionary, amongst other things. The steps were simple and easy to follow. This type of learning method, the video tutorial, has really been beneficial to me. I enjoy learning that way. eMedia also has a number of other software titles available, Rock Guitar, Blues Guitar, and they also make a number of keyboard and piano tutorials. Another software title that I found very beneficial to me is Final Cut Pro Foundations. That software title is published by a company called DVCreators.net. DVCreators.net do not just create DVD tutorials, but they also are a very handy resource for everything digital video. They have links to upcoming events. They will go in detail on different types of equipment, not just cameras, but lighting and setup. And if you scour through their DV knowledge base database, you'll find all kinds of information about DV, broadcast, web, visual effects, and more. Final Cut Pro Foundations retails for $60. It is DVD-ROM only right now, so that means you cannot play this on your DVD player connected to your TV, which is a little bit of a downside for me because typically when I do these tutorials, I like to stick it on the TV and work along on my laptop at the same time. However, that is the only downside I could find to this educational software title. They go through step by step the best way to set up your editing system. They show you some of the very important keyboard shortcuts to save you time. And they also take you step by step through a variety of settings to give you the best quality for your DVDs or the best quality for your web videos. Well, that's it for me this week. This has been Robert Hazelrig. Thank you for listening.
When you talk about superstar Macintosh authors, the name Robin Williams is always on the first team all-star pick. And Robin, we are delighted to have you here on the MyMac.com Book Bites Live podcast.
John, I'm so honored that you asked me here.
Well, we know you in under many hats, but today we're talking about you as a designer, and especially the best designer for non-designers. And the book we are specifically referring to is The Non-Designer's Design Book, Second Edition, by Robin Williams, Design and Typographic Principles for the Visual Novice. This book costs $20 U.S., $31 Canadian, and £15 U.K. The publisher is Peach Pit Press, and I will have the URL and the ISBN on our show notes. How did you happen to write this book, Robin?
Well, I've been teaching graphic design for many years, and after teaching it for so many years, I realized there were really four things that made the difference. And as I looked at, you know, wonderful designers' works and brilliant work and not brilliant work and exciting work and boring work, I realized that it was really every single piece had these four basic things that are very easy to grasp. And so when I started teaching them in my class, it was amazing the difference it made in people's work of just being able to, I think one of the key things is being able to identify what's wrong, what isn't working. Because if you can't identify what's not working, you don't know how to fix it.
And those four different principles permeate the entire book in every chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a chapter on each one of them and then pulling them all together. And half the book is actually about type for people who aren't really accustomed to type and aren't really comfortable with, I have all these typefaces, how do I know which ones actually look good on the page together? So it gives you some clues as to how to choose different typefaces that have been shown throughout history to really look great together.
Well, we know people can easily get carried away when they start working on desktop publishing. So how do newcomers achieve some sort of creative balance between boring traditional design and the wacko appearance that it's so easy to drop into? Because desktop publishing and graphics are very tempting to go overboard.
Well, you know, John, I would say that new designers are more likely to do boring things than wacko. I think it's more the designer who has been designing for a while but maybe isn't trained who is getting a little braver and wants to experiment with things and doesn't quite have an eye yet. I think they're more likely to go into the wacko area than new designers, because in all the workshops I've given and seminars and where we walk around, you know, designing things in front of each other, new designers tend to be wimpy, traditional, frightened of doing wild things on the page.
And is that why you say don't be a wimp so many times in this book, The Non-Designer's Design Book, Second Edition?
Yeah, yes, actually I do, because I would see them do things like they have a three-word headline, right? And it's an 18-point, and maybe it's an ad. And I say, why don't you think about enlarging that headline? Oh, so they go to 24-point. And I say, no, how about 200-point? Let's say, oh, I didn't even know I could do 200 points. And they do it and they say, oh my gosh, wow, now I have a focus. Now I have something that people's eyes are going to look at. But their new designers are so frightened of making things extra big, extra bold, or extra small. Not just big, you know, but small can be very dynamic too.
Well, I often see a lot of people, once they get going, they say, oh, I can have light text on a dark background. But in fact, that can be very, very difficult to read. Why do so many smart people persist in having light type on a dark background? On paper, it's okay sometimes, but often on a website, it's unreadable.
Well, being smart is completely separate from from being visually literate. In my design classes, we had a term for people call it VIPs, visually illiterate people, which are a lot of clients are visually illiterate people. We'd say, oh, you're a VIP. So I think it comes under the misguided impression that you've got a contrast there, you know, light type and a dark background, not realizing that technically the dark background encroaches on that light background and makes the type even smaller and more difficult to read. And then they make it bold because they think, oh, it's light type on a dark background, but I make it bold, which makes it another step more unreadable, less readable.
Yeah.
So it's not knowing, it's having some vague idea that, oh, I need contrast, but not knowing the reality behind that contrast. It's just a matter of not knowing, not that they're not smart. They're just, at this point, still a little visually illiterate and not able to put their finger on why is this a problem.
Well, you've mentioned type, and I've mentioned the web, so that's my lead-in to the way this book is packaged. You can currently buy this book in a boxed set of three called the Non-Designers Collection, and the three titles are the Non-Designers Design Book, Second Edition, that's by you, and the Non-Designers Type Book, also by Robin Williams, Second Edition, and then in cahoots with your buddy John Tollett, the Non-Designers Web Book, Third Edition. And I see on the box from Peach Pit Press, when you buy all three of these books, you save $10. So if any of our readers or listeners have any difficulty locating these books on the Peach Pit Press website, they can contact me and I can direct them to the Non-Designers Collection. Well, what do people learn in your books and the books that you do with John Tollett better than in college courses and vice versa?
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything that they learn better, because I've you know, done presentations and workshops around the country and have met just some fabulous design teachers who are, you know, really aware and excited about teaching. So I wouldn't say you learn anything better in these books. They tend to be used in design courses along with the instructor's program. But my original reason for doing this book was actually not for courses, but for people who weren't able to attend a college course, who didn't have 2 years to go to college.
Okie doke.
And study this. So they can get a lot. They can really, it's amazing how much their design work is impacted in a, you know, better sense, just from reading the book and using the principles in that book.
And the fourth book, go ahead.
I wouldn't use it instead of a college course. If you have a chance to go to a college course, that's great. But you will be amazed at how much better things come out just from the book alone.
That's good. And the fourth book that we're not going to dwell on, but it's in black cover. It's called Robin Williams Design Workshop, Second Edition. And sometime soon, I want to talk to you about that. But that
okay.
is it's not part of that box set. It's a separate freestanding book. But it's a wonderful book, and that's the book that I personally use more often than any others in your series. How long does it take readers of any of these books to absorb and apply your lessons and hints, you know, so the process you suggest can be implemented effectively?
Well, that's the amazing thing that, frankly, I didn't quite realize how important it was when I first did the book, but over the years and seeing how well it sells and the email I get from people, it's just four basic principles, you know, contrast, repetition, what's the other one?
Alignment. Norma, we're in trouble.
Alignment and proximity. And they're so easy. They are so easy that instantly, I guarantee, people, I mean, I can say this because I get so much email from people who are just astounded at how much better things work. And it's all based on that that principle that you can't fix it if you don't know what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say 99% of bad design is because one of these principles is missing. Once you can say, oh, I see why this flyer looks stupid, it's because of this, then, oh my gosh, you know, it's not difficult to fix it.
Good. Well, a couple of quick questions to wrap it up. Have you ever used Pages, which is part of the iWork suite? And do you have any comments on that as a valuable application to create well-designed documents?
I haven't used it a lot because I use InDesign, but I've learned it a bit to help my mother because that's what she likes to use.
Okay.
And it's a fabulous program. The key is really not in the program itself. I mean, you have to learn your program. You have to learn how to use it properly. But so what? People can learn to use Photoshop and still do ugly stuff.
Do they ever?
you can use InDesign and do ugly stuff. So it's not the program itself. So it's knowing, it's being able to put your name on what makes good design. So to that end, Pages is fabulous because you can do so many wonderful things once you know what you're supposed to do. I love Pages.
Thank you. And last but certainly not least, we know that RATS, R-A-T-Z, RATS.com, that's your personal site. And what projects are you working on now, and can we learn about those at your RATS.com site?
Sort of, because, of course, it's not up to date like it should be. It has some of my most recent projects on, including my book about the woman who probably wrote Shakespeare. Right now, I just got the beta for Leopard, and I've got to start two Leopard books that have to be out soon. So that's what my big involvement in the next several months.
Well, we have been speaking with Robin Williams, and she is the author of the Non-Designer's Design Book, second edition, published by Peach Pit Press. We've been speaking to her on Book Bites Live here at the MyMac.com podcast. And Robin, all I can say is it's always a treat to be associated with you. You, as far as I'm concerned, and as MyMac.com Book Bites is concerned, you're at the top of the top, and we're honored to have you as one of our pals here at MyMac.com.
Thanks so much, John. I'm honored that you invited me.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.